have a lot more production that we need to do as a coalition, and we need resources to be able to envision that and make that happen. Just looking at the results of the Vita sites and what that means for the community members that we're able to serve, there's immediate sense of return that you have with initiatives like this, where that means we've got dollars coming back into these communities that not only stabilizes those families in a real meaningful way, but I also think it just stimulates the local economy. So it's really a win-win from my perspective of strengthening out these Vita partners so that we can strengthen our families to get the monies that they're rightfully entitled to by law to make a stronger Oregon.
That's it for today's show. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.
And welcome to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. Today, Jeff Godsell revisits the Max Ophuls film La Ronde, and we have another whirlwind tour of some recent releases. But first, here's Jeff also on Stephen King's adaptation from 1990, the film Misery.
Stephen King had a sensational run in the 80s, getting his novels and short stories adapted to the screen, starting with The Shining through The Dead Zone, Firestarter, etc. But by the late 80s, he was trying to break away from his trademark tales of horror and the paranormal. He incorporated that conflict into the main character for his 1987 novel, Misery. In it, Paul Sheldon, famous for his best-selling Victorian romance novels, featuring the title character, Misery Chastain, kills off his main character, who he has always disdained. He then retreats to a cabin in the mountains of Colorado, as he has done before, and there writes another novel entirely, a crime novel, hoping to rid himself of the shadow of Misery Chastain and kickstart a new chapter in his career. Producer Andrew Scheinman picked up the book, Misery, at an airport bookstore during a layover and read it on the plane. Thinking that it would make a good movie, he shared it with his partner at Castle Rock Entertainment, Rob Reiner. They were amazed to find that the film rights had not yet been sold. It seems that Stephen King had held out for this special project and was waiting for the right buyer. King had admired Reiner's adaptation of King's 82 novella, The Body, which became Stand By Me, in 87, so then sold the rights to Castle Rock on one condition, that Reiner himself would direct it. It wasn't a tough sell, as Reiner saw similarities in his own situation with that of King, and also the writer-protagonist Paul Sheldon. Reiner was eager to break out of his perception as mainly being a comedy director and establish himself as a Hollywood heavyweight. Soon, master screenwriter William Goldman was hired to write the screenplay, and Misery, released in 1990, was off and running. But back to the plot. Paul Sheldon finishes his breakout novel and prepares to leave his cabin in the woods and drive back to his home in New York City. But he runs into an increasingly bad snowstorm and loses control of his car, swerving off the road, turning over, and rendering him unconscious. Miraculously, he's discovered and pulled from the wreckage. When he awakens, he finds himself in bed, but with broken legs and a dislocated shoulder. He's being attended to by Annie Wilkes in her home, not too far from the site of the crash. Annie is an ex-nurse and nurtures him back to health. She also claims to be Paul Sheldon's number one fan and reveals her obsession with the Misery Chastain series, the one in which Sheldon has just killed off the main character, freeing himself from having to continue the series. And there lies the heart of the conflict between Annie and Paul. When Annie learns of Misery's demise in the final entry, she does not take to it well. Nor does she approve of Sheldon's new novel, complaining of the use of profanity. Annie increasingly reveals herself to be far from stable. In her passive-aggressive way, she begins to put more demands on her captive guest. Sheldon realizes that he is trapped, as she is not only destroys the only copy of his newly written novel, but insists that he write a new Misery novel, somehow resurrecting her beloved main character from the dead. Sheldon dutifully obliges, all the while plotting secretly for his escape.
I'm sorry, Paul, this is all wrong.
What?
You'll have to do it over again. It's not worthy of you. Throw it all out. Except for that part of naming the gravedigger after me. You can leave that in.
I really value your criticism, but maybe we're being a little hasty here.
Paul, what you've written just isn't fair.
Not fair.
That's right. When I was growing up in Bakersfield, my favorite thing in all the world was to go to the movies on Saturday afternoons for the chapter plays.
Cliffhangers.
I know that, Mr. Man. They also call them serials. I'm not stupid, you know. Anyway, my favorite was Rocket Man. And once it was a no-brakes chapter. And the bad guys stuck him in a car on a mountain road and knocked him out and welded the door shut and tore out the brakes and started him to his death. And he woke up and tried to steer and tried to get out, but the car went off a cliff before he could escape. And it crashed and burned, and I was so upset and excited. And the next week, you better believe I was first in line. And they always start with the end of the last week. And there was Rocket Man trying to get out. And here comes the cliff. And just before the car went off the cliff, he jumped free, and all the kids cheered. But I didn't cheer. I stood right up and started shouting, "This isn't what happened last week! Have you all got amnesia? They just cheated us! This isn't fair! He didn't get out of the cock-a-doody car!"
They always cheated like that in chapter plays.
But not you. Not with my Misery. Remember, Ian did ride for Dr. Cleary at the end of the last book, but his horse fell jumping that fence, and Ian broke his shoulder and his ribs and lay all night in the ditch, and he never reached the doctor. So there couldn't have been any experimental blood transfusion that saved her life. Misery was buried in the ground at the end, Paul, so you'll have to start there.
Meanwhile, Sheldon's disappearance has been noted as his agent, played in a beautiful cameo by Lauren Bacall, notifies the sheriff of the Colorado town, who begins the investigation into just what happened to the missing author. For the role of Paul Sheldon, a multitude of actors were approached, and they all turned it down. William Hurt, Kevin Kline, Michael Douglas, Harrison Ford, Dustin Hoffman, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Richard Dreyfuss, Gene Hackman, and Robert Redford. Warren Beatty was interested but wanted to change the character a bit. Post-production on Dick Tracy prevented him from taking the role. Eventually, the role fell to James Caan, who saw it as a true challenge, and it was. Here was one of Hollywood's most active and athletic actors, forced to be confined to bed during most of the film. For the role of Annie, both Angelica Houston and Bette Midler were offered, Midler later saying that she deeply regretted turning it down. It was William Goldman who suggested Kathy Bates, who was then really only known as a stage actor. Now, it's hard to imagine anyone else in the roles. Annie's increasingly aggressive behavior and Paul's growing desperation make up the bulk of Misery's running time. What starts as a psychological cat-and-mouse game escalates into full-on terror. Everyone remembers Annie's hobbling scene where she breaks Paul's ankles to keep him from getting around. In one of the extras on the DVD for Misery, a psychologist explains that Annie actually seems to be suffering from 5 different mental disorders, including schizophrenia, depression, and a personality disorder. You really don't know what she's going to do next, but that she's capable of anything.
You see, I've known for some time why I was chosen to save you. You and I were meant to be together forever. But now our time in this world must end. But don't worry, Paul. I've prepared for what must be done. I put 2 bullets in my gun. One for you and one for me. Oh, darling, it'll be so beautiful.
Kathy Bates makes Annie one of cinema's most unique villains and got her a richly deserved Oscar. And I think it can be argued that Misery is Rob Reiner's best film. Working closely with cameraman Barry Sonnenfeld, who will soon go on to directing himself at this point, Reiner makes the most of camera positioning and close-ups for what is, for the largest part, a film shot in one room. For the purpose of elevating tension and suspense, Reiner learned from the best, like Hitchcock and others, without being showy about it. Richard Farnsworth is delightful as the sheriff, and his natural warmth and humor are the perfect balance for the histrionics going on in the Wilkes home. Besides Bates winning the Golden Globe and the Oscar, Misery did well at the box office. It remained among the top 10 of King's own favorites of his works adapted to the screen, but still not replacing the top spot, which remained as Reiner's first effort, Stand By Me. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And don't forget to drop into Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for more recommendations. And now for some quick takes.
Rangers! I just spoke with General Reaver. He just wants to know one thing. Can we hold out?
Yes, sir!
Yes, sir!
Lock and load, gentlemen.
If you can always tell a drive-in movie by its grainy images and tinny sound, and an amateur entry by its obvious video camera creation, then we can also always tell a straight-to-video film, even if there are no more straight-to-video formats anymore. They look like real movies, but the paucity of sets and the use of not washed-up actors, but performers who are no longer in the top tier. Such a film is Assault on Hill 400 from The Asylum, and it's set during World War II, November 14th, 1944 to be exact, when the 2nd Ranger Battalion is commanded to take Hill 400, which, according to the plot, rests the fate of World War II. It's directed by Christopher Wray, whom I don't know, and written by George Clymer, whom I don't know, but I do know William or Billy Baldwin and Michael Madsen, who play the military leaders back at the rear guard and telling the others what to do. Among them is Eric Roberts as a photographer attached to this battalion, who is a source of philosophical insights. For the bulk of the actors are unfamiliar to me. I would say this is a movie that one watches at 3 in the morning when there is nothing, absolutely nothing else on.
Breaking news exposing the CIA's sabotage of Iran's nuclear reactor.
No covers, Bond. We leave in 15 minutes.
Stretching point.
It's an old CIA base in Kandahar.
Another war film that's recent is Kandahar, which is also the mirror image of The Covenant, an earlier film on a similar topic by Guy Ritchie, in which an indigenous Afghani helps a white American soldier get out of a tight spot. This one is directed by Rick Roman Waugh and written by Mitchell LaFortune, and stars Gerard Butler as the soldier and Farhad Bhagari as his aide. It's fairly well done with the ups and downs that these war stories always have. Battle, pause, battle, pause. And is as competent as the Guy Ritchie film.
You're McNeely. We do not choose this life. It chose us. It'll be that way till we ain't breathing.
You know, you had goodness in your heart the minute you came into this world. You need to get out of this place, away from your daddy.
Devil's Peak from Chicken Soup for the Soul Entertainment, which I assume is a Christian organization of some kind, stars Billy Bob Thornton and Robin Wright, whose son, played by, I think, Hopper Penn, whom I assume is Robin Wright's son, is set in the backcountry and is a tale of a conflict between the father and son, with the mother, destitute, getting in the middle. It's extremely well acted by all of the major performers, but the material seems a little old hat. Andrew Saris writes somewhere that often the last film in a commercial cycle of themed movies, such as Deadly Sea Mammals, are usually the best. The first one makes all the money, and the subsequent ones cash in, but then someone finally makes one that works, and then nobody goes to see it. Well, in any case, coming late in a cycle of movies about, oh, I guess you'd call them product bios, is The Beanie Bubble. It's directed by Kristen Gore and Damien Kulosh, and is based on the book The Great Beanie Baby Bubble, Mass Delusion and the Dark Side of Cute by Zach Bissonette. It stars Zach Galifianakis as the inventor of the Beanie Baby, and Elizabeth Banks, Sarah Snook, and Geraldine Viswanathan as the ones who claim that they invented the Beanie Baby.
This has always been my company.
Company we created together.
Why do you have to be so dramatic? I mean,
my salary's been reduced 75%.
Yeah, I'm just doing what's necessary. You know, running the real, actual business over here.
Have you considered poisoning him? Countless times.
It's a lighthearted, interesting, funny account of a national obsession, and it's unfortunate that Apple Films is releasing it so late in its cycle. Meanwhile, The Story of Nintendo is a talking head documentary that proves to be highly informative about video games, at least to those who have never succumbed to their attractions. There are some real insights in this film about the rise of various Nintendo video games, such as Mario Brothers. And one of the player analysts says that she learned quickly that Mario Brothers was teaching you how to play the game from the very first round, in which everything that the game has to thwart you is thrown at you in the very first round. Anyway, this one is by Jake Hickman, and some of the talking heads are Tristan Donovan, Charlie Fisher, and Alexandra Perry, who Nintendo buffs probably know all about. Such a generous principle as Saris's notion, however, does not apply to the sudden rash of revenge films. We seem to be living in the age of Christian action films. Sound of Freedom from Angel Studios stars Jim Caviezel as the real-life fellow who was a former Homeland Security agent who quits to take on the world of human trafficking in South America and Asia. Some of the claims of the real-life Tim Ballard are disputed, and the film itself admires his Christian dedication. The movie also stars some very good character actors, such as Bill Camp, Mira Sorvino as the wife who, unlike non-Christian action films, is supportive of her husband, and TV's Kurt Fuller. God is a Bullet from Wayward Entertainment is directed by Nick Cassavetes and also written by him, and is based on a book, and stars Nicolaj Coster-Waldau as a cop who goes after the weird religious cult that has kidnapped his daughter. January Jones is also in it somewhere, although I didn't recognize her. And Jamie Foxx has a role in which he basically sits down or stands up, representing his contribution to the action film. It's a ugly world being presented in this film, and if you can stand that, one might get a little bit of pleasure out of this variation on the movie Hardcore Paul Schrader made 45 years ago. Then there's Limbo from Dark Matter, an Australian film about a cop played by Simon Baker who goes after the culprits of kidnappings of Aboriginal girls. It's in black and white, unusually, and unfortunately is highly predictable and not particularly interesting. Meanwhile, back in the realm of near reality, there are two what you might call program note films, festival items that are not meant to entertain, but to advance careers. You Hurt My Feelings from the cult distributor A24 is written and directed by Nicole Holofcener and concerns a writer played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus who overhears her husband, Tobias Menzies, admitting to a friend that he didn't particularly care for her latest book. He plays a psychiatrist who is also apparently in over his head, and among his clients are Amber Tamblyn, David Cross, and several other people recognizable from television. It is a molehill posing as a mountain, a tempest in a teacup, or any other typical cliche that you'd like to employ, and isn't particularly insightful, except for its unusual coda, in which we learn that in a marriage, it's probably fruitful to lie to your partner. Maggie Moores also gathers some TV people. I wanted to like this movie, which is directed by John Slattery of Mad Men, and stars his Mad Men co-star John Hamm as a rather lonely police officer in a small southwestern town, and Tina Fey as a homebound woman who's discovered a crime next door. Will he solve the crime and will they get together? And also, will he figure out which Maggie Moore is the one who was actually killed next door to Tina Fey's house? It's really more of a TV movie and not, and I guess is more user-friendly than Slattery's previous drama set in his hometown. Finally, there's Barbie, which I have nothing new to say, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. It's from Warner Brothers, and as you all probably know, directed and co-written by Greta Gerwig, and stars Margot Robbie as one of about 42 Barbies in the movie, and Ryan Gosling as one of several Kens, among whom there is also John Cena and Michael Cera. The movie also stars America Ferrera, Rhea Perlman, Helen Mirren, who narrates the movie, and Will Ferrell as the Mattel CEO. Mattel apparently is a pretty good sport about being portrayed in this film as some kind of weird cult. But the movie is funny, if a little bit overlong. Well, actually, a lot overlong. And does end with a very funny final sentence. Highly unusual in the history of cinema. And you are listening to Film 11 here on Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today. Next, Jeff again, this time on La Ronde.
There is probably no film director more highly regarded, yet more unknown to the general public, than Max Ophuls. In a career spanning three decades in three different countries, Ophuls maintained an astonishing level of consistency in his themes and the command of his craft. He's in the pantheon of directors in Andrew Saris's American cinema. He has influenced filmmakers as recent as Paul Thomas Anderson, who created a preface for the Criterion DVD release of Ophuls' The Earrings of Madame Day. And no one has employed the dolly and the tracking shot more than Ophuls, incorporating it into his signature style. Beginning his career in his native Germany in the early 30s, he saw the writing on the wall early with the Hitler regime and went to France. He later followed many of his fellow European exiles to Hollywood, making four memorable films, including Letter from an Unknown Woman. In 1950, he returned to France for what many consider his finest films. His first was La Ronde, the round, or the circle, like a dance or a carousel. Based on the play from 1897 by Arthur Schnitzler, it was a fitting choice for Ophuls, for one of his early successes was the adaptation of Liebelei in 1932. For his return to France, he was given some of the finest actors in the French cinema. Simone Signoret, Daniel Galen, Simone Simon, Fernand Gravy, and his favorite, Danielle Dariot. The wonderful Anton Walbrook serves as a kind of master of ceremonies, leading us through 10 intersecting stories, or amorous encounters, each one leading us to the next. Beginning with The Prostitute and the Soldier, segueing to The Soldier and Marie, then The Maid and the Young Man, and so forth. Walbrook serves as our guide and sometimes an incidental participant in the adventures, but whose main function is only to keep the wheels turning. For across social spectrums and cultural classes, these tales of love are played out. And so, in his customary way, Ophuls follows his characters without controlling them, judging them, or moralizing about them. Poets, prostitutes, noblemen, chambermaids, shopgirls, and soldiers all have a place in their room. Ophuls' famous tracking shots and dollies are an ample supply in La Rome, representing, as always, the passage of time. His characters are sometimes obscured briefly by bushes or curtains or furniture, but they're not framed by them or captured or trapped by them as they might be in a von Sternberg film. Rather, they're followed as they move inexorably toward their fateful destination. As often as not, a romantic rendezvous. Ophuls had an extraordinary rapport with his actors and worked with them with great care to capture just the right tone. This is no more beautifully evident than in the episode of The Young Man and the Married Woman, Part 2. Having finally succeeded in seducing the object of his amorous desires, the young man, played by Daniel Galen, finds himself apparently unable to perform his intended duties. In the scene, as the two discuss the occurrence still in repose upon the bed, Galen and Daniel Dariot originally played the scene for light comedy, almost for farce. Certainly the dialogue lent itself to that, and a lesser director would have opted for the safer choice. But Ophuls huddled with his actors and guided them to play the scene straight. As a result, it becomes sublime. Dariot, in particular, such a perceptive actor, understands the instructions just as she would in Ophuls' masterpiece of 3 years later, The Earrings of Madame Day. With its frank and unapologetic approach to romantic trysts, which included adultery and prostitution, La Ronde is not a film that could have been made in the U.S. In fact, it was classified as immoral by New York film censors and had to go to the Supreme Court before being approved in 1954. Even the original play by Schnitzler was not without controversy. Although privately printed in 1900, it was not publicly performed until 1920 in Berlin and 1921 in Vienna. The play elicited violent critical and popular reactions. Schnitzler himself suffered moralistic and personal attacks. Not only was he accused of being a pornographer, but the attacks had virulent and anti-Semitic tones. As a result, he withdrew Le Rome from public production in German-speaking countries. He would have preferred to extend the ban elsewhere, but a certain legal status prevented that, hence its ability to be produced in France, and ultimately made by Ophuls into the film. Schnitzler's son Heinrich continued his father's wishes after his death, even regrettably refusing permission for Laurence Olivier to stage a production at Britain's National Theatre. He could not, however, prevent Roger Vadim from making his Eurotrash remake version, Circle of Love, in 1964 with his then-wife Jane Fonda, which was a far cry from the subtle nuances of Ophuls' classic. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks again, Jeff. And again, thank you for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public